My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS. I'm really delighted that we're able to feature John Danilovich this afternoon to really kick off an enormously important issue. And John is going to talk to us about, I think, the crucial work that the Millennium Challenge Corporation is doing to deal with corruption. Now, I think there's probably nothing that is more corrosive to the development of human potential than corruption, when you think about it. It is the cruelest tax of all, because it taxes people who don't have alternatives, especially in the countries that John is trying to reach. It is everywhere. It is the wart on the face of globalization. But it is especially cruel when you're trying to help societies lift up. Now, we have tended to measure the success of foreign assistance in only one dimension, which is how much money goes out the door. And unfortunately, that's been too long the frame of reference, you know, in Washington. And what the Millennium Challenge Corporation is doing, and especially, I think, under John's tenure, is to say that there's another crucial commodity that we ought to be exporting here, not just our money. It is the expectation and the structure and discipline of good performance. And if we see two things growing in that way, we see not only the direct outcome of an investment in another country, but also the infrastructure of success over time. That's just as important a commodity. And so I really think the work that MCC is launching here, and John's going to talk to us about today, is unbelievably important. This has to be something that we're successful at, because after all, the problems around the world can give cause to a great deal of grief for all of us. We live in an era when the vector of prosperity is also the vector of vulnerability. You know, that's what the nature of globalized world is. We can't cut ourselves off from the rest of the world without hurting our own prosperity, and at the same time, we can't insulate ourselves from the dark forces in the world. So we've got to attack it, and that's what John and his team is working on. And this is a crucial, crucial dimension of that. So, John, on behalf of the audience, let me say in advance how grateful we are that you're doing this, you're taking this lead, and that you're going to share your thoughts with us today. So without further delay, I introduce to you the our president, CEO of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, Ambassador John Danilovich.
Thanks very much, John, for that nice introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking your time on this beautiful afternoon to join us and for your ongoing interest in the work that the Millennium Challenge Corporation is doing with regards to fighting corruption. It's an essential component to fulfilling our mission to reduce poverty through sustainable economic growth. From each of our 11 compact countries and our 13 threshold programs, the Millennium Challenge Corporation expects a clear and unwavering commitment to maintaining and furthering the fight against corruption. I want to thank again Dr. Hamray and the Center for Strategic International Studies for co-hosting this event with the MCC and for your help in furthering the dialogue on this important subject. Today's panel of experts, MCC's very own Vice President for Policy and International Relations, Maureen Harrington, Georgetown University's Callisto Modavo, and Transparency International's Frank Vogel, will discuss the progress made and the challenges remaining in the fight against corruption. MCC's paper on corruption adds to this discussion, and I invite you to access it through our website at www.mcc.gov. Let me say just a few words on how the MCC fights corruption and discuss in more detail why we attach such great importance, to this subject. When the panel convenes, Maureen will explain the specific mechanisms used by the Millennium Challenge Corporation to fight corruption and what lessons we have learned along the way. Let me tell you how the MCC works to reduce corruption and how we see it as fundamental to our model for delivering development assistance. Within MCC's performance-based approach to aid allocation, a key distinguishing characteristic is that we partner only with countries that pass a control of corruption indicator. It is a must-pass, a hard hurdle, indicator for MCC eligibility. This corruption indicator allows us to assess concrete government action or inaction in the fight against corruption. Countries are evaluated to determine, for instance, the frequency of additional or irregular payments to get things done, the extent of corruption among public officials, border officials, judges, or magistrates, and the effects of corruption on doing business. By evaluating corruption in this way, the MCC model guides us towards partnering with countries and directing our aids only to those countries that are clearly committed to a path that rejects corruption. I'd like to turn now to the three overreaching reasons why the MCC pursues such a staunch anti-corruption agenda. First, corruption negatively impacts development. Secondly, one of the most effective uses of aid is in the fight against corruption. And third, corruption undermines the ability of countries to graduate from development assistance and to eventually embrace private enterprise. Let me illustrate what I mean by each of these. First, corruption negatively impacts development. Research and practical experience demonstrates that corruption cripples economic growth and undermines poverty reduction. Corruption undermines investments in health and education, siphons funds away from other essential public services, increases costs, lowers productivity, discourages investment, and reduces confidence in public institutions, and produces a more regressive tax system. During a speech at the University of Nairobi last August, Senator Barack Obama summarized the ill effects of corruption in Kenya, for instance, when he stated, and I quote, "Corruption here in Kenya is a crisis that's robbing an honest people of the opportunities they have fought for. It is painfully obvious that corruption stifles development. It siphons off scarce resources that could improve infrastructure, bolster education systems, and strengthen public health. It stacks the deck so high against entrepreneurs that they cannot get their job-creating ideas even off the ground." Senator Obama's summary could very well apply not just to Kenya, but also to many countries in the developing world where corruption undermines development. Our $13 million threshold program with Kenya seeks to stamp out corruption, particularly in the public health sector. Second, one of the most effective uses of aid is in the fight against corruption. Fundamental to how we operate at the Millennium Challenge Corporation is the core principle that sound policies ensure the most effective use of aid. For this reason, we use objective, independent, and third-party indicators to assess whether a government rules justly, invests in the health and education of its people, and promotes economic freedom. This allows us to select and determine which countries receive our aid. While many donors take corruption into account in making resource allocation decisions, MCC is the only donor that currently explicitly ties eligibility for assistance to performance on a transparent and public control of corruption indicator. This has raised the profile of corruption as a policy issue and created a powerful incentive for countries to adopt tough anti-corruption laws, strengthen individual oversight of institutions, open up public policymaking processes to greater scrutiny, and step up corruption-related investigations and prosecutions. In short, just to qualify for our aid and to remain eligible for it, countries are putting procedures in place to root out corruption. We see this in Georgia, which adopted dramatic anti-corruption reforms, leading to a significant improvement in its control of corruption, indicator from the 36th percentile in 2004 to the 78th percentile in 2005. In 2002, approximately 37% of firms in Georgia reported that bribes were routinely necessary to get things done. That number declined from 37 to 7% a year later. Georgia has arrested scores of public officials, made important legislative changes that facilitate the prosecution of corruption cases, fired 15,000 members of a corrupt police force, and increased the salaries of 10,000 public servants to counter the lure of petty corruption. It's no wonder that in the World Bank's 2006 and 2007 Doing Business report, Georgia was identified as one of the world's most aggressive reformers in this field. We see it, too, in the Philippines, where in an unprecedented move, President Arroyo matched MCC's $20 million threshold program funding to fight corruption with a similar amount from the Philippine government. Corruption-related investigations and dismissals have stepped up significantly in the Philippines. For instance, the Office of the Ombudsman indicted the former Justice Secretary, and three others on charges of graft, extortion, and falsification of public documents. Additionally, an executive order mandates a seamless registration process that is expected to make doing business easier and less prone to corruption. We see it in Malawi, where we are helping build prosecutorial abilities in the Department of Public Prosecutions, the Anti-Corruption Bureau, and in the police force. Through our program, some 45 Malawians, journalists, have been trained in investigative and corruption reporting. We see it in Zambia, where integrity committees or internal watchdog units have been established and codes of ethics have been developed at key institutions to fight corruption. To reduce corruption in the border management of trade, a centralized single window process has been launched. We see it in the Ukraine, where we are helping streamline complicated and overlapping systems for providing construction permits, municipal services, land and property ownership, and customs clearance at the borders. We see it in Tanzania. We see it in other countries that we're involved in. And we see it in those countries that are strongly involved in our threshold programs to date. These are all examples of how the MCC's assistance scales up and accelerates the anti-corruption agenda of reform-minded governments. Our threshold programs are with countries that do not yet qualify for a compact with us, frequently because of poor performance on the indicators and specifically on the corruption indicator, but have demonstrated their commitment to improving performance on that and other policy indicators. In fact, the MCC Board of Directors has approved anti-corruption programs totaling more than $225 million over the past 3 years with a number of countries, including Moldova, Paraguay, Albania, Indonesia, Kenya, and Uganda. These programs focus on reforming tax administration, customs administration, public financial management, and business licensing. They are also strengthening the role of investigative journalists, public prosecutors, civil society watchdog units, and government auditing agencies in the fight against corruption. We have also seen how the incentive of potential MCC funding and our insistence on sound policies spurred anti-corruption reform in Yemen. After being suspended from MCC's threshold program in 2005 due to a material decline in overall policy performance, the Yemeni government pursued aggressive reforms, including passing important anti-corruption and financial disclosure legislation, launching a national anti-corruption awareness campaign, and retiring, sanctioning, suspending, or prosecuting more than 30 corrupt judges. These anti-corruption measures, along with other reforms, led to our board's decision in February to reinstate Yemen's participation in our threshold program. By setting a new standard for performance-based aid allocation, the MCC advances a strong anti-corruption agenda. Requiring countries to fight corruption remains one of our highest priorities, since we are serious about delivering effective development assistance that, in turn, delivers results to millions who are involved in our programs and that it will be benefited from them in the space of our implementation of these programs. Anti-corruption measures improve the delivery of essential public services and build confidence in public institutions. Equally important, these measures increase a government's operating revenues so that more can be invested in sustainable social programs to make a transformative difference where it matters most, in the lives of the poor. Third, corruption undermines the ability of countries to graduate from development assistance and to eventually embrace the private enterprise sector. By working with countries to counter corruption, MCC is strengthening effective governance as well as human and economic development that make the country more attractive for private sector investment. This is key to long-term sustainable growth that creates jobs and increases the incomes of the poor. Assistance to our partner countries is provided with the expectation that it is not open-ended. Rather, it is designed to stimulate emerging economies so that in time they can flourish, driven by private enterprise, investment, and trade, and expand and sustain opportunities for the poor. Our goal is to create a policy framework and generate the necessary conditions to make this transition possible. That is why we demand performance on indicators evaluating fiscal, monetary, regulatory, and trade conditions, including the cost and days required to start a business. That is why we insist on transparency, and that is why we reject corruption, because it stifles entrepreneurship and private investment. Because corruption suffocates development, reduces aid effectiveness, and undermines the conditions for sustainable progress through private enterprise activities, we see it as a fierce impediment to poverty reduction and economic growth. And we are addressing it with a fierce determination and priority importance. MCC is a competition for funds, and acting like an investor, we must target our resources to those partners who are most serious about their own development, which includes establishing an environment where our money is not squandered. At MCC, we're working to create a future of opportunity and prosperity by reducing poverty through economic growth. By rejecting corruption's stranglehold, we can increase the standard of living and quality of life of the world's poorest in transformative and sustainable ways. I want to thank you very much for your information, for your interest in the Millennium Challenge Corporation, and particularly for your interest in the way the Millennium Challenge Corporation is confronting corruption and doing the most that they can possibly do with regards to their programs in fighting corruption throughout the world. I'd be very happy to take any of your questions at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have a few minutes now for questions and comments. We have plenty of seats up front. For those of you in the back who are standing, please come. Feel free to come down and grab a seat. There's no need to stand up if you don't care to do that. Please identify yourself. There are microphones in the back. Arno de Borsgraaf. Arno, would you like to lead off? Please identify yourself and pose your question, comment.
Arno de Borsgraaf, CSIS. John, as you proselytize around the world against corruption, do any of your interlocutors point an accusing finger back at the United States with all the financial scandals that they keep reading about in the newspaper?
Corruption is part of human nature. It's no one anywhere in the world, no country, no government, no municipality, no individual. I think all of us at some point in our lives have had to confront the temptation, the problem, the difficulty of corruption. The problem is in a country's ability to actually try and contain what will be an ever-going and ongoing problem, because we are susceptible to this type of thing. The problem in the countries that we're operating in, that the Millennium Challenge is operating in, is that there has developed a culture of corruption. It's simply a matter of standard operating procedure. What we are trying to do is to create a culture where it becomes less of a standard operating procedure, less of a modus operandi, to allow the opportunities that create corruption to be less than they used to be. In a number of countries, we have, for example, port or customs programs, airport programs, and I think I've mentioned where we're trying to limit the points of possible corruption. It will never be eliminated. It will never be eradicated. We are trying to reduce the amount of corruption so that the state coffers can be full, so that the people in the country can benefit from expenditure on health and public welfare programs, and so that in the longer term, what is an endemic culture of corruption can be changed somewhat. There's not an accusatory figure pointed towards the United States. I think the world understands that some things are with us forever. But we are trying to do all that we can to effectively spend American taxpayers' dollars so that the money will not be squandered. Thank you.
May I just pose a question? I mean, there's a couple of issues that come forward. One is, you know, is the incentive that MCC is putting on the table in terms of buying into the compounds, is that really a sufficient incentive to overcome the incentives to engage in corruption and the weakness of institutions and all of the deep root causes that exist behind that? And moreover, are you encountering a pushback in some countries that see the entry of MCC or becoming a candidate to enter a compact with MCC as more of a political award versus a reward for good performance in governance? Mm-hmm. And so when you put forward this argument around the need to show progress and determination on corruption, is that a mixed – do you encounter a sort of mixed reaction?
You know, what we are in fact finding is that in all the countries where we have the potential to engage, that countries are willing to make the necessary reform efforts to become part of the MCC family. These reform efforts are not easy for them, either in the areas of corruption or in the compliance with regards to the other 16, soon to be 18 indicators that we have in political, economic, and social categories. It requires significant institution changing, and yet countries are willing to undertake those reforms in order to eventually qualify and become an MCC country. of course, to receive the large grants that we now offer countries. Our first country was Madagascar at $110 million. Our countries now, 9, 10, 11 countries, are around the $547 million in Ghana. So there are large amounts of money that are now being given as grants, not loans. And for this, countries are willing to undertake the necessary reforms to become eligible for the MCC. Additionally, becoming members of the MCC gives a country sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval. It gives them another means of marketing themselves in the public marketplace. They can go out and say, we're a good government, we have good governments, we do good things for our people, and therefore we are an MCC country. And by the way, since the U.S. government is willing to invest hundreds of million dollars in our countries because we are good governments, you should also invest in our country. So we've become a good housekeeping seal of approval, sort of a bond rating in disguise. And we have a number of examples where international corporations have looked at countries and said, well, this is an MCC country. They must be doing the right thing with regards to creating the institutional infrastructure, not only with regards to corruption, but also with regards to investment in their people and economic policy, to allow us to come in and have the potential to be successful with our own investments.
Thank you. We have a number of questions. Howard, and then there's a gentleman in the back. Two hands up. Let's take three questions and comments quickly. Howard?
I'm Howard Wiard at CSIS. It's a little troubling that we don't have a good working definition of corruption. And I hope you or your staff might be able to offer one, either orally or in the materials that you give us, because corruption is multifaceted and at many different levels. One thing that would be very useful, and I'd like you to comment on that, is whether MCC can distinguish between, let's say, patronage, which is chickens at Christmas and hams at Easter,
right,
depending on what culture you're in, which may run up to 5 or 6% of the cost of a transaction, versus 25 or 30%, which is your profit margin, and which I would call real corruption. So yeah. Can you distinguish between those two? How do you draw lines here in fuzzy areas where it may be 10 or 15%
right,
rather than only 5 or 6? 5 or 6 may even be deductible as a necessary business expense in quite a number of countries. 25 or 30 is not.
Right.
So could we maybe sharpen the discussion a little bit, because it's clear that this is a fuzzy area in terms of the lines that are drawn, and where can you or AID or other agencies appropriately draw those lines?
Thank you. Let's take the two other questions in the back. Yes, you two. Please identify yourselves. Yes.
Channel News Asia. Of course, there's a corruption scandal going on right down the street at the World Bank. To what degree does that undermine the work that you do? And also, more generally, how important is it for donor organizations to lead in the fight against corruption?
Thank you. Let's take a third question, and we'll come back for another round in a moment. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Joe Balser. I'm with International Decision Strategies. And at the beginning of your remarks, you gave three very good reasons of why MCC is addressing corruption. A fourth that you might want to think about is that corruption also undermines not only democratic institutions, but a population's confidence in democratic governance, as we're seeing in Latin America right now. Given that, do you see the MCC at some point pushing for either a threshold country or a compact country, working to reform political process, how political parties finance themselves and candidates? Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much for those three questions. With regards to the matter of definition, it's a great question, and it doesn't have an easy answer. But I'd like Maureen Harrington, who's our Vice President of Policy and International Relations, to perhaps expand on that further during the panel discussion. I'm not trying to dodge the question. I'd like to answer it, but I'd like Maureen to give a bit of our thinking on this. We have struggled with the definition. It's not, as I mentioned, it's not an easy answer to come up with, but Maureen will give you some of the ways we have approached this problem of magnitude, quantity, style of corruption, cultural corruption in the countries we're dealing with. I think it's very important for donor organizations to be in the forefront of the fight against corruption. I, from our point of view, from the MCC point of view, and certainly from my point of view as a U.S. government agency responsible for receiving U.S. taxpayers' dollars, I've just been through the appropriations process up on the Hill, and I'm pleading for my own budget, and I have no intention of treating that money without the great respect that it deserves and for the great efforts that it's intended for. And therefore, I think it's certainly incumbent upon the Millennium Challenge Corporation, and I take it as a personal responsibility, to make sure that that money isn't squandered in the countries we're dealing with. So it is a hallmark of the MCC that we are committed to the fight against corruption, and that's why we have it as the one indicator of the 18 that must be passed. The others must be passed 50%, but this one must be passed before we can go forward. And there are a number of examples that I mentioned in my remarks, but we also have on our website, where countries have undertaken serious reform efforts in order to become eligible. One case that we're particularly proud of, if I can put it that way, isn't necessarily in the area of corruption specifically, but was in the case of Yemen, which was suspended from our program and then brought back in again because they had undertaken serious reform efforts on a broad spectrum of activities, including judicial reform and corruption and things of that nature. And this was spearheaded by the MCC suspension of Yemen, but other donors joined the bandwagon and said, well, if you're going to do this for the MCC and clean up your act, well, you should do it for us as well. So it became sort of a joint effort. And in subsequent donor conferences that have been held with regards to Yemen, with us at the forefront, with us having been the motivating force for these reforms, other donor organizations, countries as well as NGOs, have gotten on the donor bandwagon as well. So I think it has to be a hallmark of organizations that are involved, particularly those organizations that are spending taxpayers' money. With regards to the reform of the political processes, we have engaged in a number of countries with regards to political process reforms, political party activities, and that type of thing. But there again, I'd like to ask Maureen Harrington to explore that and expand upon that further when the panel has their opportunity to talk to you this afternoon.
Should we take one more round? We have a questioner here. Please identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Deanna Gregg with BNA. Given the administration's focus on results-oriented for development aid and that that's also been the focus with the World Bank, I'm wondering how would you feel about taking that job if, as everyone pretty much expects, Mr. Wolfowitz to resign at some point? If it's offered to you, will you take it?
I'd like to ask our Vice President, Maureen Harrington, to answer that question for me later this afternoon. Let me answer the first part of your comment in any case, or make a comment on the first part of your comment. We are results-oriented. We like to call ourselves a business model. I am a businessman. I've only been in government for a few years. We're not really a business model, but we use business jargon, and we do have benchmarks, and we are results-oriented. And we're now at a place, which is a great joy, where we can see in the implementation and evolution of our program that we now have results, and we can talk about results in specific countries where farmers, where farmer cooperatives, where agricultural programs are beginning to show results, and the wonderful people that are benefiting from our program are already talking about the next phase and the next project and what happens when they fulfill the next benchmark. So even people who are illiterate and are unable to read the compacts they're on are able to tell me, well, I know that on page 46, when I do what's done, what's asked to be in paragraph number 2. Paragraph 3 says I'm going to get 4 wheelbarrows and 10 pickaxes, and I'm going to get more fertilizer, and I can buy those 10 acres of land over there because I now own my land, and I can do what we are trying to help them to do. So we have the results of these programs. I sincerely hope that the World Bank, which I actually believe is a great institution and needs to be a greater institution, will find a resolution to their problems in the near future. I think it's dragged on for an unfortunate a period of time and has been a great burden to the effective and efficient operation of that organization. And I hope that Mr. Wolfowitz, who was taken over that position with the confidence of the U.S. government, is able to continue in that post, or if he is not able to do so, that the organization will find the internal strength to go forward in a strong and effective way, as it should.
Thank you very much. I want to join, if you please join me in thanking Ambassador Danilovich for this presentation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We're going to move to the second part of our afternoon. I'd like to ask Maureen
Callisto and Frank to come forward. We're going to have a roundtable discussion here this afternoon. You sure you don't want to stay up here? Sure, why don't you stay up here with us? That would be useful. I'll just get another chair. Hi, Callisto.
Hi,
Frank. Come on up. When we organized this day, and I want to thank Elizabeth Sullivan, a special thanks to Elizabeth Sullivan from CSIS and Jennifer Nevins from MCC for helping put this together. It took quite a bit of work of trying to think this through. We thought, let's, you know, with the advent and the release of this paper, important paper on corruption, let's hear from Ambassador Danilovich, and then let's take an opportunity to have a more detailed discussion that will bring in some other opinion of some of the practitioners, some of the folks who've been sort of leading lights on these issues around corruption. And so that's how we settled upon this mixed formula, which I think is a very good one. The way we're going to proceed here is that Maureen Harrington, the Vice President for Policy and International Relations, is going to lead off with some additional commentary around the process of actually struggling with the reality of corruption as they move forward and advance the MCC programs. Let me just quickly introduce Maureen. I think it's a very interesting combination or profile that she brings to her work. She has an MBA and a Master's of Business Administration from Harvard. She has combined that with very lengthy work in political development overseas with the International Republican Institute, a long stint in South Africa, and a quite in-depth experience in electoral preparations, electoral administration, and observation in a broad range of countries in Africa and elsewhere. We worked together very closely with Maureen when she was an assistant, a special assistant to then Assistant Secretary Walter Kansteiner earlier in this decade when Congressman Wolf put forward an appropriation for an Africa Policy Advisory Panel. That was a very fruitful experience, and it was one that brought forward very strong bipartisan cooperation. This was something that Secretary Powell commissioned and oversaw. He came and spoke at the release of the report in the summer of 2005. It involved Senator Feingold and others as members, and of course, Congressman Wolf was the godfather of the entire process. And it brought home, I think, the centrality of bipartisan consensus in moving forward things like MCC, PEPFAR, and other sorts of initiatives. And we published as part of that effort a paper by Paul Applegarth that was one of the sort of early, very detailed and factually centered analyses around the kind of work that an MCC could accomplish. And we're very proud that we were able to do that. So Maureen, in her role today, oversees the selection process for countries that come forward as eligible for compacts as well as threshold. She manages the threshold program, which itself is a complex and exciting part of the work that goes on, and has lead responsibility on donor coordination. After she's spoken, we're going to turn to our other two speakers. Frank Vogel to my right, also a very varied career. For the last 17, 18 years, he has been a publisher based here in Washington. But in that period also, while being a very successful publisher, he has been one of the pioneers of the transparency movement as a co-founder and for a long period, throughout the 90s into the early part of this decade, as co-chair of Transparency International. In an earlier phase of his career, he was a journalist, began his career in Britain. He was born there, was educated there, had the wisdom to come and move here. He has been a journalist in both settings. He joined the World Bank, where he rose to a fairly senior job there in external relations, public affairs, and has carried forward the interest in both multilateralism, in transparency, and in the centrality of these issues around the way our foreign assistance is administered. Our other speaker is a good friend of CSIS and someone very well known here in Washington and very revered, Callisto Madavo, to my left. Callisto, for a period of 96 to 2004, a very long period, was the vice president for the Africa region. He was the leading light here in Washington for the bank on a myriad range of issues pertaining to Africa, and he acquitted himself remarkably well. This was a difficult period, a very difficult period in Africa, a period of great stress and followed by a period of recovery. The bank undertook a number of innovative programs in that period. He was at the forefront of the bank becoming active on the HIV/AIDS issue, for which we're very grateful. We do a lot of work here at CSIS on HIV/AIDS. Callisto's remained very, very involved as now chairman of the board of the International HIV/AIDS Alliance, a very important initiative, and it's very important that he has personally made that commitment in such a dramatic way. He's a Zimbabwean. We rely on him for his insights in this dark period that Zimbabwe finds itself in which we all puzzle over what can or should be done by us and by others in this period. He's a PhD in economics from Notre Dame. We're very pleased that all of you have taken so much time out of your day to come for this important gathering, and we're very grateful. So on behalf of everyone, thank you. So, Maureen, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve, and thank you, all of you, for being here. I'm really happy to have this opportunity to talk to you a little bit about our work and what we've learned and what we're experiencing in our assistance to countries in the fight against corruption. And this opportunity is a very important one for us. We've spent a lot of time with our colleagues in the U.S. government who are assisting countries in the fight against corruption, but we also are excited about this opportunity to expand our network with all of you and with other practitioners who are working in the field and learning lessons that we need to apply to our work. So we're very thankful for this opportunity today that CSIS is providing to us to get some feedback and to have a frank conversation with all of you. So again, thank you for coming. The ambassador, in his remarks, talked a lot about why MCC is focusing on the fight against corruption. I'm going to talk a little bit more about how. MCC uses, I guess, three mechanisms to address corruption in our programs, and I'll run through each of them for you. They're described in more detail in the paper that we've been referring to, which I think is in the packets that have been handed out for this meeting. And I'd like to begin by recognizing Brad Parks from the development policy team at MCC, who wrote that paper and did all the research that went into it, and also Sherry Cram for her leadership of the development policy team. Thanks to you both for all your hard work putting this together. So the first mechanism MCC uses to address corruption is through our competitive selection process that the ambassador talked about, and the strong incentives for reform that we're seeing simply by making this opportunity available for countries to participate in our program. And the response to this incentive has been very strong. It's something we call the MCC effect, where countries take action to work on policy reform without us really having to do much aside from make the promise of future eligibility a possibility for them. And to give you an example of some of the things that we're seeing, there have been 14 countries that have not qualified for MCC assistance, but that have established ministerial level committees or presidential commissions to devise, implement, and track reforms related to the MCC indicators. And to give you an example of this, the ambassador was recently in Guatemala, and the Berger administration has shown a great deal of interest in becoming a threshold country and ultimately a compact country. And the government has formed working groups to examine all of the MCC indicators, and they've devised reform strategies to help improve their performance on each of them. And to give you a sense of some of the actions that the government has taken, they've begun prosecuting high-ranking officials on charges of corruption. They've created a financial crimes unit. They have hired a foreign accounting firm to audit congressional spending. And they're launching an online disclosure of government procurement. So these are all things that the government's doing, not solely, of course, to become eligible for MCC. It's part of the government's reform program, but all under, as part of this ministerial task force. So we're very excited to hear about that. I think we're also seeing this incentive for reform continues on with the compact countries. I think there's was always concern if once countries became eligible for a compact, if their reform efforts would carry on. And in some cases, we're seeing slight declines. In other cases, we're seeing steady performance. But in many cases, we're seeing improved performance. And that's I think leads to something that the ambassador mentioned earlier too, which is this good housekeeping seal of approval, which countries really appreciate. We've had a number of countries even say to us sort of quietly, we don't even want the money. We just want to be one of your partner countries so we can tell the world that we've met certain standards and that we've met the standards that the United States places for being part of the MCC process. So they think it's an important signal to the private sector and donor community, and we are exploring ways to keep this incentive alive through the compact implementation period. And to give you an example of a compact country that's sort of moving along with reform, El Salvador, as part of its MCA team, has hired a team member that's responsible throughout compact implementation for monitoring their progress on the indicators and making sure that they're continuing to improve and maintain performance. And they've done some interesting things. The government of El Salvador has reduced opportunities for corruption by slashing the number of days it takes to start a business from 115 to 26 days. And this has yielded impressive benefits, a 500% increase in business registration, and a sharp spike in customer satisfaction among business registrants. So we think that's great, and that's the kind of reform that we're trying to encourage throughout the compact process. The second way that we're addressing corruption is much more directly, and that's through our Threshold program, which is designed to scale up and to accelerate the anti-corruption efforts of reform-minded governments. And these Threshold programs are anchored in three key principles. The first is that this notion the ambassador talked about a little bit of country ownership, we believe is very important to the anti-corruption efforts as well, because political will is sort of a necessary foundation for any of these anti-corruption programs to work. So we try to anchor our Threshold programs in reform efforts that are already underway that we can expand and grow and to help facilitate. The next principle of the Threshold program is that they really need to be tailored to the country context. So some people will say, well, what does a typical Threshold program look like? And they all look very different because they're meant to solve different problems, and the root causes of corruption in many of our partner countries are different. So when we work through the Threshold program, when we first get started, we do a very detailed diagnostic of what some of the causes are of corruption in the countries where we're working. And in some cases, it may be the judiciary. In some cases, it may be government procurement. I mean, it varies from place to place. But that diagnostic is the key starting point so that we can get a sense of what are the key drivers. The third principle of the Threshold program is really that measurement matters. Just like in our compact program, we go to great lengths to try and measure what impact our programs are having on corruption in these countries. And we're just beginning to learn. I mean, these programs are being implemented right now, and this is one area where we'd really like to learn more from other folks in the field who are thinking about ways to measure the impact of anti-corruption programs. But for our efforts, we link the activities to improvements and benchmarks that will lead to improved performance on our corruption indicator. Now, one of the other things the paper covers, and I don't want to go into too much detail, I've already been talking long enough, but we talk a little bit about the five key lessons learned, and they're outlined in our paper. But I'd like to give you a few concrete examples of how we're trying to apply best practices that you all have learned in our efforts to fight corruption. So one lesson that we highlight in the paper is that you need to change the risk-reward calculus through deterrence of corruption. And so in the Philippines, our indicator diagnostic revealed that corruption was concentrated in tax and customs administration, and that one of the reasons why was because there was impunity for this kind of problem. So we worked with the government to design a $21 million threshold program that would step up enforcement in tax and customs administration as part of a broader program. And the basic premise behind the program is that corruption is not a crime of passion, it's a crime of calculation, and that people tend to engage in corruption when the risks are low and the penalties are mild and the rewards are significant. And therefore, the central goal of our program with the government is to change that risk-reward calculus by creating an effective deterrent. And deterrence requires sending a signal that the existing culture of impunity will no longer be tolerated. And therefore, we're working with the government's Revenue Integrity Protection Service, and the government is assessing whether the lifestyles and spending habits of the Tax and Customs Administration staff match the wealth that they've declared in their public asset declaration forms. And if they find that it doesn't, these folks are they work through the government's ombudsman to investigate and prosecute corrupt officials. And a substantial part of our program is also strengthening the ombudsman's office to be able to play that role. Another example of how we're applying best practices in Tanzania, where several components of our threshold program are anchored in the principle that sunshine is the best disinfectant. And this program has a strong focus on building the monitoring capacity of NGOs and journalists. And as most of you know, there's a huge body of research showing that a robust civil society can deepen and sustain political will by mobilizing public support for reform, arming reformers with useful information, shedding light on public abuses, exposing vested interests, and persuading powerful elites that reform is actually in their interest. In Tanzania's case, the government there decided that the key challenges was a lack of capacity and non-governmental organizations to conduct the monitoring role that was needed for them to play. And this was especially important in a country where they have 123 local governments that all are, you know, the closest aspect of government to the people. And we also learned that there wasn't a strong investigative journalism culture in Tanzania, and they wanted to strengthen the media's ability to play an oversight role. And so our program there is working with NGOs and journalists to provide training and capacity building for them to play their oversight role, as is expected. And we're starting to see some results there. In 2006, there were 56 stories a month appearing in the press about corruption. By 2007, that number had doubled. So journalists are doing a better job of trying to understand what the corruption levels are in their country and to expose them. And the final way that MCC is working to address corruption is by setting a new standard for performance-based allocation and trying to help institutionalize the idea that foreign aid is really a two-way street. And if donors are going to be providing more assistance, recipient countries need to provide greater accountability, deliver results, and this includes in the fight against corruption. And, you know, I think the ambassador talked quite a bit about this, and we're starting to see some interest in the donor community, and whether it's due to MCC or just the greater effort that's being made in the fight against corruption, we are seeing other donors looking at our model. Australia has recently set up an incentive fund where eventually 10% of its foreign assistance budget will be based on independent indicators similar to those used by MCC. So we think that's great, and we're glad to see other donors exploring our model and thinking about ways that they too can be creating an incentive for good reform. So again, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm looking forward to answering the questions you've already posed, plus any others that come up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maureen. We're going to turn now to Frank and Callisto for their commentary to kick off the discussion here, and then we'll open things up. Frank, would you like to start off?
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Steve. I'm delighted and frankly amazed that I'm here this afternoon. About 17 years ago, a handful of us sat around a small table and considered the completely lunatic endeavor of thinking of creating an NGO to fight corruption. At the time, there wasn't a single aid agency that was willing to accept publicly that fighting corruption was a major issue that they should address. There was not a single aid agency that thought that a program in this field was important or politically viable for them to meaningfully address. Callisto may recall, because we were together at the World Bank, how really this issue did not come up in a meaningful way in the 80s when we were the managing committee of the World Bank. So here we are. We now have an agency, the MCC, totally dedicated to this particular idea. I think that's marvelous. I think it's staggering. Ambassador and your colleagues, good luck. And everything that I'm going to say, I hope you take in a very constructive and positive way. Against my amazement, I have to tell you that we have struggled in Transparency International and in allied area organizations to try to understand what corruption is really all about and how to curb it, both the curbing of bribe paying and the curbing of bribe taking. We today have 90 national chapters around the world and a vibrant civil society movement. And there are many, many hundreds of other civil society organizations today in the world in developing countries that are engaged in aspects of anti-corruption. So first of all, let me just comment very, very briefly on what I think we've learned and then how to place this against the context of what the MCC is trying to do. Very briefly. First of all, we've learned how little we know about curbing corruption. We know that we are fairly naive, fairly young, fairly innocent in a game where there are very entrenched, embedded networks of corruption involving top business people and top public officials in many developing governments of the world. These are very flexible, very smart individuals, very adaptable, and very good at gaming the system. And compared to them, many of us who are trying to do something about them, because they are the problem, are finding it very difficult, and we find that we have a huge amount to learn. So we are humble in what we think we can expect. Second of all, we've learned that it is very fashionable for politicians seeking public office everywhere, including the developing world, but not exclusively, to come out with huge anti-corruption platforms and campaigns. They then get into office, and at first they look as if they're doing things that are really great, which pushes them up, of course, on World Bank indicators. Then they continue to sound the rhetoric, but it's a bit harder to determine the actual performance. And then they go into the next phase time and time again. And if you don't believe me, try Kenya or Ukraine, just as a couple of recent examples. In Kenya, can you believe it? This country that is now getting, continues to get aid flows from various donors, has reinstated the thugs as ministers who John Githongo exposed as pocketing tens of millions of dollars only a couple of years ago. So they go through it, then they're exposed, and suddenly their rating on these instant quick indicators suddenly falls, but only temporarily. What we've learned, I think, is that the cycle is rather predictable, that we should never be too optimistic, that the attempts by bold politicians so often fail. The rhetoric at first sounds great, but later we have to recalibrate and rethink. This is a very, very long-term hard struggle, and we believe that one of the lessons learned is that seeing short-term results and declaring victory is a very, very rash thing to do. Another thing we've learned is that good governance depends upon the public support of all of the public and not just amongst leaders. Leaders will only truly reform and sustain reforms if they face continuous grassroots public pressure. We have found time and time again that the willingness of aid agencies to converse only with the leaders and to listen to what they wish to listen to without adequately understanding the domestic, public, grassroots conditions in those countries leads again to the waste of public resources. A next point I'd like to make, a final observation about general lessons learned, well, not a final, but another, is that we have learned that in countries where there is not economic growth and sustained economic growth, it is especially hard to introduce anti-corruption reforms, even if the public demand in those conditions for such reforms is particularly great, and that it is absolutely vital to take into account what the country is doing in general economic performance and the policies to secure its economy when one looks at what the chances are of an anti-corruption program succeeding. And finally, on that same point, we've also learned that in countries where the respect for the rule of law is minimal and where the public has very, very little confidence in the rule of law being equitable and being just, the attempt to introduce anti-corruption reforms is especially difficult. And many of the countries that you will find who are perceived to have extremely high levels of corruption, many of the countries on the Corruption Perceptions Index of Transparency International, towards the end of that index, the lower part of the index, are countries which have one thing in common. The public themselves in those countries has extremely low levels of confidence in the judiciary and in the police. And we have found, and we have a tool called our barometer that measures this, we have found that police bribery in many of those countries is rampant and undermines so much else that is attempted to be secured. Okay, having said all that, how does this apply to the MCC? Let me, first of all, just talk about results. The MCC talks a lot about results, and I understand the political pressures. However, we believe, from our experience, that results come very, very slowly, that they're very, very difficult to measure, it needs a great deal of patience, and that World Bank indicators, however numerous they may be, are very young, very untested, and are at most a very rough guide that should frankly be treated with a certain pinch of salt if one's serious about this game. Why do I say that? The industrial countries approved an OECD anti-bribery convention in 1999, and it still hasn't been enforced 8 years later. We could all claim victory because the new laws were passed in so many countries, but the reality is that without enforcement, this convention certainly hasn't benefited anybody or really promoted anti-bribery. We could all look at all of the countries that have received World Bank aid for judicial reform, where Western consultants, high-paid consultants, have gone in and rewritten laws for countries and improved new systems for training judges, but where, sadly, judicial corruption is still massive and the laws have not been enforced. And if you want evidence of that, please buy the Global Corruption Report that we released on May the 24th of this month, which deals with corruption in the judiciary worldwide. Another point, public support. If these programs do not secure, if not just the MCC's program, but all anti-corruption programs, and I'm thinking of the World Bank too, if they do not support grassroots public support, they will not be sustainable. And there has to be, therefore, a far bigger effort, I think, by the MCC and, frankly, by the World Bank, too, to really learn from the grassroots, from business people, university people, from church leaders and civil society, country by country, as to what they believe is doable and how they can become involved in continuing the pressure on their governments to secure reforms. If you don't involve civil society at every stage of the game, in planning, in monitoring, in evaluation, then the programs won't be sustained. Another point, I'm running out of time, so I've got to be very fast. Let me just emphasize to you the belief that, my personal belief, that you narrow your success opportunities by limiting yourself to governments as clients. The fact of the matter is that in many countries, the governments are barely, if at all, legitimate. They may claim to be the counterparts, and they may have nice embassies here in Washington, and they may their leaders may have nice expense accounts, but they are not respected by their own peoples. In fact, in many countries, they have come to power through fairly illegitimate systems and elections which are called multi-party elections, but which many people would at best consider questionable. If these anti-corruption programs are to work, they must have legitimacy. That means that the public, and I'm including the media in these countries, must be free enough to talk about them properly. It means that there must be constant efforts to try to secure public understanding and public commitment for the programs. There must be parliamentary oversight in these countries of the programs, and there must be full transparency of what these programs are all about. Moreover, if you want another indicator, may I suggest to you that you also look at the defense spending of all of these countries to which you are lending to. Most of them do not publish their defense budgets, and we all know that the largest single source of international corruption, apart from construction, in public procurement is in the defense sector. And that is a black box hidden by so-called national security, which, frankly, the publics in most countries are worried about. My final point, if I may, final 2 points. Firstly, please consider also giving grants to civil society organizations in many countries that are fighting corruption. I'm privileged to have helped to create and be on the board of a group called the Partnership for Transparency Fund. We give grants of a maximum of $25,000 for each civil society group. We've just got a $600,000 grant from the Inter-American Development Bank for 6 Latin American countries. We are finding that there are many civil society groups with very small amounts of money that are making a difference in their communities. And if you get enough of them doing it, the overall impact can be substantial. So please don't just limit yourselves to governments. And the last point I want to make is that people matter. Individuals matter. We gave an integrity award at TI last year to a wonderful woman who basically, single-handedly almost, successfully prosecuted 1,500 people in the former Fujimori government in Peru for corruption. 1,500. Ana Cecilia Magallanes Cortez did an incredible job. She, Jorge Ugas, John Githongo, Devendra Pandai, and I could go on and on and on, are the individual enormously courageous leaders around the world who are fighting corruption. Why don't you ask them to join your advisory groups? Why don't you get them and others like them to advise you dispassionately, objectively, about whether what you're doing is really making sense? If you did that and they published their reports, your credibility would be enormously enhanced, and I think your impact would be. Thank you very much.
Frank, thank you very much. Callisto.
Thank you, Steve. As the last commentator here, I think a lot has already been said, and I don't need to, I think, dwell too much on too many details. But I did want to begin by saying I found the paper from which you were summarizing very well done, and I speak as somebody who spent donkey's years in a large bureaucracy, reading a lot of, double speak, and so on. This paper was concise. It's easy to understand. Yes, we can talk about how we define corruption and don't define corruption, but by and large, it was written in a way in which, even the village idiot would understand why it was important to focus on this issue. For me, I think the contribution by the MCC and in the MCC approach lies not around the question of research, generating new ideas, and so on, because a lot of these have been around for quite some time. I think the contribution and the innovation, as far as I'm concerned, has been around the question of how do we apply some of these concepts? How do we implement some of these ideas? How do we learn from experience and feed back into the way in which we design programs? And I think it's also very important, it seems to me, that the MCC focus on corruption is situated in a much larger context. Corruption, fighting corruption is important, but fighting corruption in an environment in which there are poor policies for growth and poverty reduction doesn't take you very far. So that I find, therefore, the emphasis on the importance of continuing to focus on growth, on poverty reduction, and within that context, to address the issues of the use of resources in a way which is understandable. Three categories, 16 or perhaps 18 indicators. Provided by and large by independent third parties. In most of the agencies that I'm familiar with, they cook the books from within. And most of the time, the way in which these things work is very much a black box. And in some cases, it's only recent that we have seen some of these scores being made public and being shared with the partner countries that are supposed to understand how they are being rated, how they might be able to improve. So it is this transparency, it is this application that I think is a real value added. But I also think that it is important that MCC is not taking corruption as a sort of a single issue. It's not just focusing on the single issue. You have to pass the corruption control index in order to get aid. But the question I would ask is, if you pass the corruption control index, but you had bad policies, didn't invest in people, you didn't promote private sector and growth, would you, in fact, qualify for MCC funds? I hope not. I hope countries that were clean, but in fact pursuing policies that don't lead to growth and poverty reduction would not be considered as adequate for funding. Again, I think I like very much the point that Maureen emphasized on the how. All of us know what, but the difficulty has been in the how. How do we go about, in fact, pursuing these very worthwhile goals and objectives? And I think this idea of introducing competition in the way in which you select your partner countries is important, although sometimes one gets the impression also that there's a little politics in the way in which some of these countries are selected. But I hope you can reassure us on that particular point. I think the idea of putting out there as the key driver the issue of incentives is absolutely fantastic, because I come from a tradition where conditionality was the basis on which we made a lot of decisions. And then when these conditionalities weren't lived up to, we still nevertheless gave away the store. So, I think the issue of incentives is an important one. I also think that the issue of working through government systems and improving them by working with countries to promote ownership, adaptation to local situations, customizing, in other words, measurement, all these factors, I think, are a very, very good step forward in the way in which one should be implementing these anti-corruption programs. Of course, there will be a price. Some of these steps will mean a slower pace in the way in which you move towards these objectives, but I dare say a much more sure-footed way in which one is moving towards them. And I would rather choose slower, sure-footed pace than a quick and rather fragile basis for proceeding. I also admire very much the aspiration, and mark you, I'm using the word aspiration, by the MCC to be a leader of development practice in this area. Very much take on board the five principles that would guide the way in which you would go about this. Presumably, that learning process is continuous and that these principles are living principles. They can change over time based on the experience and on the lessons learned. Now, let me, to close, say two or three points on the way forward. I agree with Frank that in many ways, much as I admire what the ambassador said and my panelist, Maureen, said, we have to admit that it's early days. I mean, these programs have been going for how many years?
Three.
You know, we need, I think, to be modest in the way in which we stipulate the successes, and we need to keep an eye out for the need for evaluation, and I hope independent evaluation from time to time to tell us whether or not one is moving within the parameters of the compass. The second thing I would emphasize on the way forward is that governance, improved governance, cannot be driven from outside. However, the goodwill of the external aid agencies and others. You know, the only thing that is sustainable, the only thing that is going to have lasting value is a process which is internally driven with support from outside, but basically internally driven, in which the demand side for some of these measures that we're talking about through non-state actors, Frank's point, and other measures are strong. The question I would have for MCC is, how much are you putting into capacity building? You know, how much are you putting into capacity building, not just with governments, but with the totality of the societies within which you're working? Again, Frank's point about working with civil society and engaging them becomes important, but also with the agents of accountability, the institutions of accountability, parliaments, audit agencies, and others in these countries. My final point is around the issue of learning. I said I admire your aspiration to be the lead and the leader in this area in terms of implementation. But how much are you investing as an agency in learning? Peer learning, in learning that involves other partner countries, other agencies, because it is only through that that you can leverage some of the experience that you have had and therefore impact the way in which not just you, but your other travelers in the donor community carry out the work in this area. So mutual learning for me, it's very, very important, and a mutual learning that also involves, you know, the bottom-up process, the communities, ordinary citizens and groups that can then hold governments and leaders accountable for their actions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Calisto. Those were all very, very thoughtful. I want to offer one quick observation and put one additional issue on the table. The observation is that it seems, just listening to everyone here, that in the last 15 years, there's been mixed things that have happened. On the one hand, there's definitely been a shift of norms, a greater consciousness of the power of corruption, and the emergence of new institutions that are very seriously dedicated to this. And MCC is joining the ranks of the Open Society Institute of Transparency International, the World Bank, and others that have staked out this domain, and as well as the civil society organizations that have been referenced. And that begs the question of how does it relate to those, to that span of organizations. The other counter trend in this last 15 years is the sort of one that's been detailed by Moises Naim in his volume Illicit, and others arguing that globalization has in fact played very, very significantly to the advantage of criminal syndicates, that in terms of information technology, mobility, speed of communications, that sovereign entities are in fact sluggish and in fact an obstacle, and play very much to the advantage of those who are attempting to make use of these new opportunities that globalization present for corruption and criminality, and that in fact we're losing the game, which is a powerful argument. And in his book, he explores five or six sectors where he lays that out. So that's one quick observation. The issue that I wanted to get on the table is China. We had the head of China's Exim Bank here right here 2 weeks ago, talking about their practices of lending. They're going into countries that are weak institutions that have a long legacy of high corruption, grand corruption. They're also going into countries that are regarded as well-performing countries that are many of the same candidates that you are looking at as both compact countries and threshold countries. So, and they are making extremely big plays in infrastructure. They're making a bet on transformation that's not unlike yours. Only it's one that is very explicitly grounded on the notion of non-interference, non-conditionality, no strings attached. It's a completely different sort of logic around what is in that compact. And it's based on an optimism that Africa's poised for development. It's based on an optimism of a solidarity and a partnership, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when confronted with the question of, aren't you getting really nervous putting $9 or $10 billion of loans on the table to Angola for the Benguela railway transformation, the Melange transformation, the refineries, the ports, and everything else? Or aren't you getting nervous in Nigeria or Equatorial Guinea or Ethiopia or Kenya or many other places where there are rather staggering levels of resources going in that are in many cases vastly larger than what MCC is putting on the table, but in some instances quite comparable? The answer was not that, yes, we're nervous and we have to move beyond non-interference and start embracing the doctrines of MCC. The answer was, we're very conscious of these hazards, and we're going to take care of them because we are bringing in the labor, bringing in the management, and engaging in turnkey operations, and we've budgeted for the maintenance of those operations well into the future. So we're not really losing all that much sleep about whether we're going to create enormous new abandoned white elephants on the landscape of the Plan Alto in Angola that everyone will be laughing at us in 10 years' time. Now, we're, of course, bringing tens of thousands of labor and the like. So on the one hand, you have this kind of new partnership, this model that's a business model, it's a partnership model, it's really a sort of it's a new logic that you're attempting to pursue that is more respectful and deferential of your partner governments. It's premised on reform. It's premised on transparency and accountability and benchmarks. And then you have this other model that's coming forward that's radically different,
backed by huge resources and political alliance and pressure. How do you tie those together? Because these are active in the same countries that you're looking at.
Why don't we go back to the ambassador and Maureen? There's a lot of issues on the table. Maybe we could get some comment, and then we could come back to our audience. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve, and thanks very much to the panelists for their very prescient comments on the Millennium Challenge Corporation. I'd like to address a few points that Callisto mentioned and the subject of China, and perhaps turn other points over for Maureen to discuss. We are a young organization. We have only been in existence for almost 3.5 years, created by an act of Congress in 2004. And I was recently up at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and I gave a speech not only on corruption but on the MCC in general. And I was asked at the end of it by one of the people in the audience, well, you seem very confident about this model. And the confidence comes, frankly, from the confidence of youth. We are a young organization, and yet we are already able to see certain results in the way this model is working. And it's exciting to see those results and exciting to start to see success. The success are modest, and we are modest in our understanding of ourselves as well as to what we have achieved so far. But as we see these achievements start to evidence themselves as countries are implementing their programs, it is exciting for us to see that. And we, believe me, have our feet on the ground. We are very much aware that we are an experiment in progress, a work in progress. We are constantly reevaluating ourselves internally, going over internal processes to make our processes better. We are engaging with countries and re-engaging with countries to get our processes also in country correct. So we are very much aware that we are struggling to make our model better and to function better and to produce better and to have better results and to have results on the ground, not only in tangible forms of sustainable development, of economic progress, but also with regards to the critical areas of institutional reform which we believe are absolutely necessary for our programs. It really is a two-pronged effort. One, the institutional reforms which we require as per performance on our indicators, as well as the performance on the compacts themselves, on the project themselves. So, yes, we are aware of our youth. We sometimes enjoy the confidence of our youth, but are also very aware that we are a work in progress and we're trying to get it right, philosophically speaking. With regards to politics, it's a question that often comes up. We are a U.S. government agency, but we are an independent U.S. government agency, meaning that we're not part of the State Department. Some people initially thought we were. And I have to go to Congress just like anybody else does in this government to ask for money. And I want to assure you that there have been a number of instances within the U.S. government where we have come into head-to-head conflict with other agencies, including the State Department itself, where we have embarked upon a decision or a path which was contrary to what the State Department wanted or elements in the State Department wanted or other areas that we deal with, the Department of Treasury, other government agencies. And we have remain steadfast in the conviction of the decisions that we have taken straight across the boards. And so far, we are confident that those decisions have been the correct ones. I would also like to say that the Secretary of State, who happens to be the chairman of the board of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, the Secretary of the Treasury is the vice chairman, I'm the CEO, we have representatives from USAID, U.S. Trade, and four independent, so to speak, members of the board. The Secretary of State has also been always supportive of our decision-making process. Of course, as my chairman, she is aware of the decisions that we make. We advise her of our decisions. We consult with the State Department. We consult with many other agencies. But we have never had a situation where we have been asked, either by the executive branch or by the State Department or others, to do something in a specific country for a specific reason, either by the president himself or others on his staff, as the case may be. That's not to say that every country that we deal in, whether it be in Albania or Paraguay as threshold countries, or in Central America, where we have three countries, Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, in Africa, where we have several countries as well, Ghana, Benin, Burkina Faso, in Georgia and Armenia, every single country in the world is of some interest, strategic interest, to the United States of varying degrees of various importance and significance. But that is not something that we take into account when we embark upon an engagement with a country. We are about the reduction of poverty. We are about
sustainable development for the people and for the benefit of those people that receive our grants in those countries. With regards to China, it's a reality which cannot be ignored. And I think, Steve, you used words that we very much care about. We are engaged with countries, and we are respectful and deferential to them. We are about the solution of their own problems. We ask them to create and develop and implement their own solutions to poverty reduction. We want them to take pride. We want them to have the pride of responsibility, the pride of ownership, the pride of accountability throughout the life of our engagement with them. Yes, we provide the money, but we want this to be their project. We want it to be their solutions. We want them to solve their own problems in the hope that this will give them the dignity to move forward and will actually advance the agenda of poverty reduction and sustainable growth. We are not in our countries as extractors. We don't arrive with large sums of money and take things out. We're there to make investments in the country that we're involved in. Others that we have discussed earlier are involved, as far as I'm concerned, as extractors in these countries. They're not involved in sustainable growth. They're not there for the welfare of the people. They, in fact, not only bring their own money, equipment, but their own people to do the work. I can't see how, over time, this is going to be a benefit to the countries they're going to be involved in. They might have their coffers expanded dramatically in a short period of time, but I think it's unlikely that's going to lead to any sustainable growth. And it seems to be that countries in Africa and in South America, where the Millennium Challenge is operating, and China, countries are beginning to realize that maybe this isn't such a great thing for them to have the type or the structure of relationship they presently have with China. And I wouldn't be surprised if the structure of those relationships change over time.
Maureen, did you have any comments?
Sure. Just a couple of things. There were a number of comments and observations about how much capacity building is involved in the program, how much is civil society involved, and sort of working with groups in the country that are outside of the government. And let me just say a few things about that. Our threshold programs, I don't have a figure with me right now, but the majority of what we're doing in the threshold program is capacity building, whether it's providing support for judicial reform often takes the form of training for judges and prosecutors. It might involve training for police forces. It might involve, when we're working to root out corruption in customs, there's a fair amount of training involved in that. So capacity building is the foundation of the threshold program, I would say. We do spend some money when we find that there is a key gap in a country's ability to perform a function because they don't have IT systems to track customs properly or to manage cases in the judiciary. Then we will make investments in infrastructure in that way, but the programs are largely based on capacity building. We also, in many of our programs, involve civil society in a number of ways. First of all, in the design of the program, just like in the compact programs, we expect civil society to be engaged in the discussion that we're having with the government about how they want to use this opportunity to fight corruption. And so as a result, there are civil society programs that we're financing through the threshold program, whether it's working with the media in Tanzania and NGOs in Tanzania, as I mentioned earlier. In Malawi, we're providing financing to the parliament to help play a better oversight function on government expenditures. We work with auditor generals in many countries to help them play a better oversight function. And again, there are elements of capacity building and technical support in all of those areas. So while the government is our partner, and this is an agreement between the United States and our partner countries, it's fundamentally that we do have civil society getting engaged in both program design and implementation. Frank had asked a little bit about the spending issue, and are we asking countries how much they're spending on defense? And the answer is no, but we sort of get to that question another way. Our indicators in the investing in people category ask, you know, we monitor country spending on health and education. And in some ways, that's asking the same question in a different way, because if countries aren't putting resources into health and education, well, then where is it going to something that may be you know, not in the best interests of its citizens. So hopefully we're getting to that a little bit, although we don't ask the question directly. Callisto raised the issue of peer learning, and fundamentally that is what today is all about. Part of why we wanted to come here to CSIS and really appreciate this opportunity is that we're trying to foster a more public debate about these issues. We really want to learn from other folks in the field. We are 3 years old. Our threshold programs, I think the one we've had been implementing the longest has only been going for a year. We're just beginning to learn, and we recognize we don't have all the answers and that we really want to start engaging in a much more frequent and meaningful way with folks like yourselves who are doing your own work in anti-corruption, and we really welcome that and hope that there will be avenues to follow up to this event. The same is true with our donor partners. We work very closely with other donors in countries where we're working on anti-corruption efforts. We participate in a number of swaps or sector-wide approaches where we may only be picking up a piece of the anti-corruption agenda and trying to solve it in a very thorough way, knowing that other donors are dealing with the remainder of the problem. So we coordinate very closely with other donors in our threshold programs, just like we do in the compacts, and we really are trying to learn from other donors on what are their best practices, how can MCC apply them, because we really have no ambition to recreate the wheel here. We don't want to lose any time relearning the lessons that you all have learned before us. So that's something that's very important to us. On the issue of living principles, the paper was really meant to just generate some discussion. And I do believe that as we continue to implement these programs and you all in the course of your work, that those principles will change. And I think that will be a good thing to happen because it means that we're learning. It means that we have more information. And it means that we're sharing it. So maybe a year from now we can revisit those principles and see what else we've been able to discover in our work. I think those are some of the main issues that were raised. Thanks,
Thank
Steve.
You. Ambassador Danilovich is going to have to excuse himself now. We're going to continue for a few more minutes. Thank you so much, Ambassador.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
We'd like to open this up and take comments and questions. Please be very brief. One comment or question, 1 minute. We have Jim Michael here in the front. We have a gentleman in the back. We're going to bundle things together here so we can take a number of comments and questions. Jim?
Thanks very much. First of all, congratulations to CSIS and MCC on a really fascinating program. I would like to say as a witness up close that there really is an MCC effect. And having seen it in the case of El Salvador, it's not dealing with countries that are totally corrupt and offering them a prize to stop being corrupt. It's countries that are reforming where the incentive is added to accelerate their reforms and support mm-hmm. their reforms. And I think in that context, the MCC effect is very real. My question is, recognizing that MCC is just a part of the effort that is underway with regard to the internal resources, the internal dynamics, and the international resources and dynamics, I'd like to get the impressions of the panelists, and particularly Callisto and Frank, about how this leadership and development is going with regard to other participants. My impression is that maybe a little bit less money is going into anti-corruption efforts from some of the other donors. My impression is that the World Bank went backwards from where it was last fall to where it is this spring with the anti-corruption policy. And you know, what are the trends that in which MCC is just a part of a broader effort to make the scourge of corruption be a lesser impact on development?
Thank you. Hold for a second. Let's take a couple of others. There's a gentleman in the back. Please identify yourself.
My name is Manelis Dubasa from the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Chair, from a journalistic point of view, I'm not going to be academic about this topic. I'm going to be practical as possible. One of your speakers was telling us about a period whereby there was a lot of rhetoric around this topic. From a journalistic point of view, I think that has been replaced by double standard. One of the biggest, or perhaps to be fair, the most talked about corrupt practice globally right now is across the street here at the World Bank. I just want to get it from you, the panel.
I thought you were going to talk about CSIS.
I just want to get it from you, the panel. What's your view about this? Since every board, I just went through the website of the newspapers, Britain, South Africa, everywhere. This is the topical issue. What's your view on this matter? Should Mr. Wolfowitz go, or should he stay? And secondly, to the MCC, the support, unequivocal support of the American government to Mr. Wolfowitz, who even the panel, the board of executive or the ethics committee have said that he has broken the rules. Do you think it has made a huge blow to your efforts of leading this fight against corruption? Because when you go to Tanzania, everybody would be laughing at you, really, when you talk about this, when your government is supporting this thing.
Thank you. Thank you. Can we take a third question here?
Hi, I'm Sarah Rose with the Center for Global Development. My question is that now that more and more threshold countries are becoming fully eligible for MCA compacts, can you talk a little bit maybe about how you sort of systematically plan to incorporate the achievements that you have throughout your threshold program in combating corruption into the compact proceedings also, considering that they're implemented by two separate agencies, and how you intend to try to keep the anti-corruption theme going through the compact proceedings also?
Yeah. Let's take one more question. The woman right behind here. Please identify yourself.
My name is Constance, and I work for a Nigerian daily newspaper. My question is, during all the talk, I haven't heard the MCC say it's partnering with Nigeria. This is important because it's the most populous nation in Africa. And since 2003, the government has launched an anti-corruption campaign, set up an organization, you know, and it has made a big issue out of it. So I don't know if this says that the government's fight against corruption is not credible or that it's not genuine. So I'm just wondering why the MCC has not considered Nigeria to be one of the countries it should partner with. Secondly, I haven't also heard the MCC talk about the aspect of anti-corruption whereby there is a connivance between officials in the developing country and the developed world. That aspect is very important because it happens all the time, and it's often overlooked. So I don't know what you're doing about it. Have you considered it at all? I have
okay.
a third question.
Thank you.
Okay.
Nope. That's it. We're going to start with Frank. On the World Bank issue, I mean, quite beyond the whole question of does Wolfowitz go or come and or stay, maybe each of you could comment on why has it been so difficult and rocky a road in this last year in moving forward that anti-corruption priority.
Should I just answer that, or should I?
No, I think you should choose among them the array of questions.
Okay. Let me just make three very brief answers to three questions. One was yours on China, and let me just say, the countries perceived to have the highest levels of corruption, have the highest levels of human rights abuse, have the highest levels of media censorship. And my fear is that the way the Chinese are going into some countries with high levels of extractive potential industries and resources, they are going to set back the agenda of reform in each of these areas. So it's not just anti-corruption. It's human rights. It's poverty alleviation. It's media freedom. And I think we have to be very, very concerned about that. Second point, if I may, was your question about where do we stand in all this, how are we going, what's happening. Naturally, a lot of the press is about the setbacks. But we've seen, and I would take a longer time frame than just the 1 year, if I may, an enormous progress. I think the coming on stream of the MCC, and now that it's getting into its stride, is enormously helpful. But we're also seeing a lot of very constructive support from the EU in this area, and from individual agencies in the EU, and I would recommend to the MCC that they look at the DFID program of the UK in support of civil society. They might add that to the MCC agenda. But in addition to that, we are also seeing businesses across countries now doing more than ever before to look at least at business principles and anti-corruption principles. That's a long way from action, but it is helping. We are seeing far more civil society groups involved in the environment, in human rights, in political reform, and in anti-corruption coming together far more than ever before. And each of these groups are also finding ways to interact and to exchange views constructively. So I'm actually quite optimistic about the general trend, despite the news about the World Bank in the last year. Let me finally make a point about to your question about the World Bank. And here let me very strictly put on my Transparency International hat. Since we were created 15 years ago, we have never once come out and called for the resignation of a corrupt official. If we were, our list would be extremely long. We would even include, perhaps, Tony Blair, given the way he quashed the investigation of BAA Systems in their contracting with Saudi Arabia, an investigation into bribery there. So we have taken a view that there needs to be a due process, that everything regarding this incident needs to be made transparent and public, and that the due process itself needs to be seen to be just and to be equitable. Over the last period of time, by the way, I should just make one point. I was a journalist for many years, and I was so critical of the World Bank that they hired me. So I have a bit of experience there. Final point on the World Bank, if I may. The World Bank has struggled for about 10 years now, since 1997, to try to put in place effective anti-corruption strategies. They have learned a great deal. The learning curve is very high. They still have a huge amount to learn, and if anybody has any doubt about that, they should look at the World Bank's Operations Evaluation Report that was published only 2 months ago, which is extremely instructive and comes from inside the bank's system itself. The bank's contribution to the anti-corruption environment and to the anti-corruption work is formidable. The bank is still a leader. And it is very, very worrying that it is now going through a crisis that may undermine that leadership. Therefore, it is critical that this matter be resolved in a way that enables the bank to restore its leadership in this area, which I believe it can, but I don't think it will be easy.
Let me just make three quick points. The first one, I can't resist, Steve, I'm sorry, which is to make a comment on China. I happen to think, for Africa anyway, China is an opportunity, but also a challenge. And that what we need to realize is that the Chinese have interests, the Africans have interests, and I think one effective way of really helping in that relation, and the international community has interests, one way is to empower the Africans to be able to engage China to protect their own interests. There cannot be a pretense by the West of protecting Africa from the Chinese. It just not on the deck. On the bank and Wolfowitz, I'm one of the 42 former senior officials who signed the letter to the FT. So that should give you a sense of where I stand on this issue. That's all I need to say. But I think the lesson that I take on the way in which the anti-corruption agenda went since the fall, since Singapore and so on, is that, you know, it's one thing to have very good ideas, very good intentions. It's particularly important to proceed in a way in which one creates a consensus and a buy-in by major constituents to the idea that you're trying to pursue. Because none of the people who quote-unquote, were opposing whatever Mr. Wolf always wanted to do, are against the anti-corruption agenda as such. It's the way in which the thing was put together that they objected to. Number three, Nigeria. It's very, very important to my sister journalist there that Nigeria tackles issues of governance, corruption, and so on. And we saw what Minister Ngozi Uwela was able to do in a short period of time. But we also saw that she started goring certain vested interests, and guess what? She was moved from her job. So, you know, it's not the fault of outsiders that Nigeria is not being engaged. Nigeria has to take the lead, and I think the Nigerians have a lot that they need to do to help themselves before they can externalize that problem on other people outside the continent.
Thanks. Just a few answers to the specific questions to MCC. And Nigeria, they are a candidate country, which means that they are they participate in the contest, in other words. Their data is part of the pool, but at this time they don't score very well on the indicators. I don't have their scorecard with me, but it's on our website, as are the scores of all of the countries that are candidates, and I would encourage you to look at that, and I'd be happy to follow up with you after this conference if you want more information on that. There was a question about how we keep the anti-corruption theme going through the compact, and there are two ways. There are some countries that were selected as threshold countries that moved on to compact eligibility, yet their threshold program was still underway. And in a case like that, we insist that our country partners continue to perform under the threshold program and that the programs continue to achieve their targets and whatnot while they're going through the compact process. And frankly, that's worked quite well. And we have a number of countries working on both. And we think it's important that just because a country becomes eligible for a compact that they finish off the anti-corruption program that we designed together. And then secondly, I think under the compact, there are a lot of efforts underway to fight corruption, whether it's through establishing fiscal and procurement systems that meet our standards and establishing the government taking responsibility for implementing the program. And MCC has very rigorous oversight of implementation that, again, we hope prevents and deters corruption from taking place with our funding. And some countries have selected to include capacity building in their compacts for things like improving procurement systems and things of that nature, which contribute to the fight against corruption. But to be quite honest, it's really in the threshold program where we're making the deepest investments in anti-corruption. And then lastly, there was one question about, well, our country partners still taking us seriously despite what's happening at the World Bank? And I would say, yes, we haven't seen a big turnaround just because of what's happening at the World Bank. I think we have the luxury of working with countries that really want to reform. There's no obligation to participate in an MCC threshold country program. And so it's countries that meet our standards. We provide an opportunity, and then it's up to them to submit a proposal and to design a program that will help improve their score on the indicator. So I think what we found is that the partners we're working with were serious about corruption or fighting corruption or, you know, had the will to at least give it a go. And that's why they were selected to be part of our program. So I think also, it's that we're supporting their overall reform efforts. It isn't, MCC going to a country saying, you must do this or you must do that. It's really our country partners deciding how they want to fight corruption. And as a result, I think there's a lot of civil society support for the programs and within the government itself. Thanks.
Thank you. We've gone on now for almost 2 hours, so I think we will thank our, on behalf of everyone here, I want to thank our three speakers this afternoon. This has been quite lively and rich, and I think we all come away with a much better sense of how you're thinking this through. Maureen and Ambassador Danilovich, and for Callisto and Frank, thank you so much for all of your insights.